Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Thursday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. Thomas B. Sawyer, the lead teleplay writer for Murder, She Wrote, says the writers for the classic CBS TV show used to affectionately refer to the lead character as the Angel of Death. Week after week, the kindly and inquisitive Jessica Fletcher, played of course by Angela Lansbury, just happened to be on hand when someone was murdered, and week after week, she played a key and sometimes heroic role in the investigation. By the end of the series, she had just happened to be in the right place at the right time to help out with a whopping 264 episodes worth of deadly skullduggery. Central Oregon had its own version of the Angel of Death in the form of Professor Ray Van Buren Jackson. His record wasn't as good as Jessica's. He played a starring role in only 3 oddly similar homicides and had bit parts in 3 more. His record is worse in another way, too. None of the murders of which he helped in the investigation were ever really solved. Lake County historian and journalist Melanie Tupper is the scholar who identified this pattern during 7 years of research through back issues of local newspapers and courthouse records, along with interviews with locals. The whole story is in her book, The Sandy Knoll Murder. Here, as briefly as I can make it, is a synopsis of Jackson's record as Central Oregon's Angel of Death. Rest in peace. J. Creed Conn, March 4th, 1904. John Creed Conn, prominent Silver Lake merchant and owner of a mule team freight line, disappeared on a frosty morning while going to fetch the mail for his store. 7 weeks later, after an extensive manhunt, his well-preserved body was found staged on a little hillock, the Sandy Knoll, on a nearby cattle ranch. Put there, it appeared, in an attempt to suggest that one of the ranch's cowboys had done it. Before planting the body, the killer had beaten the face to unrecognizability and shot it a second time using an old Colt 38 he'd stolen from Conn's store. The coroner's jury, apparently concerned to protect the cattle ranch from bad publicity, ruled it suicide, something very few people bought, given how difficult it is to shoot oneself twice with a single-action revolver and then beat one's own face to a bloody pulp. Other circumstances were also suspicious. Conn, at the time of his death, was trying to figure out what had happened to the proceeds of a $3,000 loan that was missing from his bank account. This missing money was never found, and Conn's brother had to pay the loan off with the proceeds of his liquidated estate. Jackson ate breakfast with Conn on the morning of his murder and was the last person to have spoken with him. An important witness to Conn's last activities, he provided key testimony to law enforcement on what was said and where he went after breakfast, and he gave detailed information also for newspaper stories. Jackson also knew about the $3,000 loan which Conn had taken out. And Jackson was a convicted forger. Could it be he forged a promissory note to steal the $3,000? Conn would have asked the bank to send him the note back, and upon receiving it, he would have instantly seen what had happened. Could Jackson have asked him to meet with him privately so he could give back the money and then given him something else instead? This is a scenario that's imagined by Tupper. I personally suspect it's probably accurate, but we'll never know for sure. Sure holds together as a story, though. And get this, Jackson bought about $3,000 worth of cattle right after Conn disappeared. He sure didn't finance that purchase on a schoolteacher's salary. Rest in peace. Zelma Ethel Martin, April 1st, 1904. Just a few weeks after Creed Conn vanished, Ethel Martin, an 11-year-old schoolgirl, stayed late at the schoolhouse where Jackson was the teacher. A half hour after arriving home that afternoon, she died of apparent poisoning. Her death was ruled accidental. There was some strychnine nearby, and it was believed that she had eaten some. But strychnine is very bitter, and no 11-year-old would eat it on purpose. Moreover, it kills in hours, not minutes. Tupper argues she more likely ate something laced with a more subtle poison, such as arsenic, at the schoolhouse, possibly after discovering something relating to Khan's body, which, if Jackson was the killer, would probably have been stored there. Rest in peace. Julius Willende, December 27th, 1907. Julius Willende was a young homesteader, just getting started, new to Silver Lake. There is no clear connection to Jackson except for some spooky similarities to the Khan murder. Willende was shot to death, then the killer warehoused the body for 11 weeks before beating the face to an unrecognizability and planting the body in the creek near where Khan was found, artistically arranging it so it would freeze into the ice face up. The killer then communicated prolifically to the press, writing an anonymous letter to the Portland Oregonian to help guide searchers to the body, and after a suspect was wrongly identified, another anonymous letter giving details of how to find him. Rest in peace. Emma Dobkins, March 2nd, 1910. Officially, Emma Dobkins died of angina pectoris in Lane County. However, Lake County residents said she committed suicide after a, quote, tainted relationship with Jackson, who was a great pal of her brother Frank. She may very well have died naturally in childbirth while trying to deliver a baby conceived with Jackson, but angina pectoris chest pain is a strange thing to list as a cause of death, especially for a woman under 30. But well-meaning people tried to protect her reputation afterward by being vague on the documentation, so it's hard to know for sure how she died or what, if any, role Jackson might have played in her death beyond having apparently gotten her pregnant. Rest in peace. Harold Bradley, December 29th, 1925. Harold Bradley was a hired hand on Lincoln Link Hutton's large and successful ranch. He was shot twice with a .30-30 while going with Hutton to work on a car. Link Hutton's wife, Leona, testified that after the first shot, she heard him yell, "Link, you've shot me." Jackson, a neighbor, testified in the subsequent murder trial that Link came to his place and confessed to him. Link was acquitted, so apparently the jury didn't believe it. There is some evidence that Jackson and Leona Hutton were having an affair at the time. Could Jackson have planned to shoot Hutton and frame Bradley, then move in with the widow? Hutton and Bradley were built similarly, and there wasn't much light. Perhaps that bullet was meant for Hutton. By the way, Bradley's wounds were survivable, but he did not survive them. Perhaps this is explained by the fact that he was left alone with Jackson for an hour after the shooting. Rest in peace. Ira Bradley, May 1st, 1930. Ira Bradley was Harold Bradley's father. He was found beaten to death with the butt of a revolver at his ranch, a mile and a half from the Harney County line. His face, too, was beaten to unrecognizability. The killer planted evidence at a neighbor's house, but the neighbor had an alibi. He was in town buying a new Ford when this happened. Luckily, another neighbor was on hand. This neighbor helpfully called the Harney County authorities, forgetting apparently which county he lived in. Harney County officers came, checked out the crime scene, loaded up the body, and took it to Burns, and then discovered it was Lake County's case. In the ensuing confusion, much footprint evidence was lost, and the killer was never identified. And yes, by now you know exactly who that helpful neighbor was. Rest in peace. Professor Ray Van Buren Jackson, February 1st, 1938. Jackson was found dead in an upstairs room of his house, having apparently shot himself with a .30-30. Oddly enough, he chose to shoot himself in the chest, not the head, using a stove poker to actuate the trigger. He was 68 years old. One particularly odd thing about Jackson's record of helpfulness is that this list covers a significant slice of all the murder and suspicious death cases in Lake County from 1899 to 1930. There were others, but this list hits the high points and then some. Each time, there was some connection to Ray Van Buren Jackson. Indeed, in most of them, Jackson was a central player. What are the odds? In her book, Tupper makes the case that Jackson was a sociopath and a serial killer in an age that didn't really know what either of those things was. She was probably right. He displayed some of the characteristics that we associate with sociopaths. Glibness, absolute lack of social fear, impulse toward grandiosity, promiscuity, one of his names was Tomcat Jackson, that kind of thing. But you don't have to buy her argument about that to see that there was something funny and deadly about this particular man. He was an easy liar, a great actor, an accomplished forger, and a serial embezzler, among other things. He was entrusted with an entire community's school children for a decade, and at least one of them died under suspicious circumstances right after coming home from his school. And nearly every time there was a brutal, suspicious homicide somewhere in Oregon's third largest county, he just happened to be on hand, helping out, giving advice, talking excitedly with the cops and the press. The pattern is hard to miss, isn't it? Tupper recently released a follow-up book in which she makes the case for even more murder victims of Mr. Jackson. It's titled The Trapper Murders, A True Central Oregon Mystery. It lays out a pretty convincing case for several additional victims. This story was first published on September 12th of 2012 under the headline Central Oregon's Own Angel of Death. The key source was Melanie Tupper's book, The Sandy Knoll Murder. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 500 stories originally created and published in newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, pulp-lit.com, which is a boutique publishing house owned and operated by yours truly, specializing in audiobook and multimedia editions of the work of the classic pre-war pulp writers. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons license type CC by SA 4.0. Basically, that means you can do anything you want with the content. Reprint it, remix it, add to it, songify it, post it on your blog, fire up the old Cessna and skywrite it, whatever you want to do, as long as you A, give me credit for it, and B, whatever you make is also released under a Creative Commons license. But hey, if you need either A or B waived, hit me up, fj@offbeatoregon.com. Don't let my old middle school principal fool you. I actually do play well with others. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, or maybe you'd like to get together and have a cup of coffee or a pint of hammerhead and talk history, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it, and the next one will be a Friday episode, which means it'll be brand new. So until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.